But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shodell, and I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, you know, obviously we taped this show a couple of days before. I'm just enjoying this weather. I mean, it's got to be almost 60 out, you know?
I must be the luckiest guy around because even though I was working, I was outdoors a lot yesterday. On Thursday.
I heard you were in my old stomping grounds, Montauk.
Yeah, I was out in Montauk.
And love Montauk.
I was out there on Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday was a little chilly.
Yeah.
But okay. Still, the scenery is incredible.
Phenomenal.
Disappointed in that I was very busy work-related and not really familiar with the landscape in the sense that I had to go to Gurney's.
Now, you're a Nassau boy, right?
Yeah. But usually the event that I'm involved with is at the other Gurney's, which is the Yacht Club. This time it was at Gurney's itself. And I didn't remember where the village was as compared to Gurney's. And I guess I would have had to continue on.
Yeah, just keep going east.
And then there's the IGA mm-hmm. and Montauk Manor and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to see any of that. But there's something to in 65-degree weather around 4 o'clock, driving up and just facing the water.
It's fabulous.
And seeing the sand. And there was some pretty nice waves. I haven't been out to Gurney's in 40-something years.
Really?
Again, I've been to the Yacht Club. Way back when, the weekend that Princess Diana got married, mm-hmm. We were out there. We had a room right on the sand,
mm-hmm.
On the beach, and it was incredible out there. And spa services, and we had friends that lived out in Montauk, and they actually rolled up to our patio and picked us up and took us out to dinner.
Nice.
So it was really cool. But there was a lot of mixed emotions. I had this love for the area. We also, the family, had a townhouse. I don't know if you, Stepping Stone?
Yeah.
Was an area, like, on the way to Gosman's.
Yeah.
A little townhouse development.
My partner built that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So we were supposed to, the family was supposed to, you know, try it out, and then they bought some property. But my family was, they didn't know how to enjoy anything. You know, it was the type that, oh, we love the beach. It's just the sand that bothers us.
Yeah, well, you know, I think happiness is 90% choice and 10% circumstance,
So we had the opportunity to really enjoy. I used to go out there Thursday nights. I was the lead guy who'd run over to the IGA, put stuff in the refrigerator.
Sure.
And it would be a great weekend. All dissipated. I'm divorced, and that was my it didn't all come together.
It's my past life.
But, subsequent to the adventure where our friends picked us up, their son was going to Syracuse, and he was on one of those foreign exchange programs, and he went down in a Lufthansa crash.
No kidding.
And that was pretty tragic. I was only about 20-something at the time.
Wow.
And not used to death at all anyway.
Yeah.
But that was just like...
Yeah, that's traumatic.
But the woman was a sculptor. And apparently she's put together some sort of memorial out there. And I had read about it, never got to see it. But again, between which was supposed to be a great time in my life out in Montauk, some sadness about the loss of that family.
Sure, yeah.
But then again, getting out there and just seeing the landscape. Oh, my God, it's so gorgeous.
Yeah, I lived out there for about 7 years. I had a restaurant out there in the 90s, and it's my favorite one that I ever had. It's not the one that made me the most money or anything like that, but it was my favorite. I never had so much fun. I had a partner, Mike Buffa, who was a complete maniac and a lot of fun and just the laugh a minute. And, we did 7 years out there. But I learned that at the time, the seasonal business wasn't really what I was good at. Because what would happen was, you know, you really made all your money in 12 weeks out there. You had 12 weeks. If it rained, you had eight. You know, I mean, it depends on the weekend weather. But what I would do is, you know, we would open in like April, end of April, beginning of May. And we would close like the end of November. And then I had nothing to do. Now, you can't give me that kind of free time because I can do really some dangerous things, right? So left to my own devices, I was a disaster back then. So I would go away. I went to Mexico for 8 weeks. I'd go down and, you know, visit my friend Billy Valentine in New Orleans, whatever. And then I would drink my wine cellar dry, and then I would have to start over again. I would be broke and, you know, destitute, and I'd have to build the whole thing up again. So it was a seven-year cycle, and it just got to be a little too much as I got older. But I loved it there, man. It was, you know, my restaurant was a half a block off the beach. You know, between, you know, like we weren't really open for lunch, but I'd be prepping all day, right? So right before dinner, I go down, I jump in the ocean, I come back up, I take a shower. We had a, you know, an office upstairs with a shower, and come back down refreshed and ready to go. It's crazy. You know, Montauk, we used to do, you know, you do 250, 300 dinners a day, you know, for 10 weeks or 8 weeks. It was just nuts, you know. And you'd work 7 days a week. And I had a crew of guys from Antigua that used to come up. They would work the Mill Reef Club down in Antigua. And they'd come up and they would live with me in the summer and work there. And we just had a ball. It was just great, you know. I actually miss it. It was one of my favorite restaurants. It was called Downtown Grill, and we just had a ball.
And so many of the things you just mentioned, it just brings back thoughts. You said, you know, jumping into water. So I guess it was in, I guess, the mid-60s or whatever, but a group of people decided they were going to jump into the ocean at night.
Yeah,
I'm
never
not a polar bear guy.
It's so, never a good idea.
I got to believe it's a lot of fun afterwards when you remember about it. But and then you mentioned, you know, lunch, and I guess the lobster roll is now called lunch.
Well, lunch was that's the, you know, the sign. It says lunch. Everybody knows it is lunch. You know, it's the name.
And then
the
there's one,
roll.
I guess, now in Southampton.
Yeah, they took over the diner in Southampton.
Yes.
And there was one on the North Fork too, but I think he sold it to.
See, now you, there you go too. So again, I'm a little. I guess I never got the gene for geography, so I'm driving out to Montauk, and I remember, oh, I need to go to the Modern Snack Bar.
Good luck.
How close am I? And then I realized, I guess that's the North Fork?
Yeah, it's the North
and
Fork.
And I'm sort of at the South Fork?
Yeah, you're an hour and 20 minutes away, you know. Montauk's a special place, though. I mean, you know, it was really, when I was there, it's changed a lot. It's got a little Hamptonized now, you know, with the advent of the surf club. The surf club came in Montauk, and it just changed everything. But when I was there, it was still kind of it was starting its renaissance, you know, the restaurants were taking the plastic lobsters and the fishnets down off the ceiling and doing some serious food or whatever. But it was still kind of a, you know, a fisherman's.
And what years did you have your restaurant?
I was there from, I think, 91 to 97 or 98.
So I was out there prior to that.
Yeah.
I mean, but what's funny is some of the restaurants are still, you know, Shagwang.
Oh, Shagwang, yeah. Jimmy Hewitt. Yeah, you know, the Hewitt family's had Shagwang for a long time. I think it's sold now. He probably sold it. But, it you know, Montauk is special. It was like it went untouched by time. It was this anachronistic place that just, you know, existed basically because of the fishermen. They used to have a bumper sticker that says, you know, Montauk. A cute little drinking village with a slight fishing problem, which is the and then they had another one, you know, it had summer people and some are not, you know, so it was fun. It was like, you know, us against the world, you know what I mean? You're always kind of, you know, you couldn't wait for the tourists to come out there and you couldn't wait for them to go home, you know?
Yeah, no, I again, it just, you know, you when you go in the old days, when you went to the beach, you know, you could put your arms out and there was nobody on either side of you, you know, not like going to Jones Beach or Long Beach or whatever. It was just more relaxed, more a great place to be.
Montauk is just there's nothing like it, you know. I'm a Hamptons guy. I mean, I like East Hampton. I lived there for a long time, and you know, I have friends there and my band is based there, and you know the restaurants and the clubs, it was always a lot of fun. But the Hamptons kind of got weird, man. It just got, to be too much. There's too much entitlement, too much money, too much of everything, you know. And it's changed a little bit, you know. The people still go out there. I mean, you know, you have people who own a home there and a home in L.A. and a home in, you know, whatever. I mean, there's real money out there. I mean, scary money out there. And some people you never heard of. I mean, we all know the superstars or whatever, you know, TV and personalities and movie stars or whatever. But there's guys out there, you know, named Smith and Jones that you never really heard of who, you know, bond traders and hedge fund guys that have gazillions of dollars.
So the Montauk scene is one thing. Then I'm talking to some people earlier in the week, and the guy said, you know, I used to have a boat. I used to go ocean boating or whatever, and, you know, I sort of got turned off when, like, I felt something knocking at my leg as I was getting into the boat, and it was a shark. So he's now doing lake boating, which he says is a whole different scene.
Yeah.
And he was talking about somewhere in North Carolina, and he goes, the scene down there is so different.
Is that Lake Norman?
That's what it was.
Yeah.
And he goes, everybody rafts, so I guess everybody connects their boats together.
Yeah.
And in extreme situations, they'll raft around an island, and there'll be concerts on the island. There'll be tractor, the liner from a tire.
The tube?
The tube.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would be floating around, like they'd have their own channels.
Yeah.
And there would be a keg floating around, everybody just taking advantage of it and stuff. But he goes, I don't have to worry about anybody bumping into me when I'm getting out of the water that I have to be concerned about. No vermin in the beast in the water, as he said.
Yeah, my friend Jimmy just moved down there. Jimmy Waters, you know, from Waters Crest Winery.
Oh, that's where he ended up.
Yeah, he's down in Lake Norman area. And, you know, for the first time in my life, there's like a wisp of a thought in my head about, you know, should I stay on Long Island? I mean, I've been, you know, a Long Island native son for a very long time, and, you know, I've kind of built my life here and whatever. And, but, you know, every once in a while I start thinking, it's so expensive and it's so crowded now. It's just not the same as it was when I was growing up, you know?
So he was talking about that area. Then they start talking about Florida and Naples. Naples is the new Boca.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like you were saying before, they were talking about money. He said it's just crazy. There's just so much money down in that part of Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess just like in Montauk. And to be honest, I can't fathom that. I guess I just have a blue collar life
mentality, yeah.
You know, and finances, but you know, they were talking about $400,000 boats, and
and
the boat isn't as expensive as what it costs to
keep it,
keep it, and you know where it's got to be docked. And,
and
my head is spinning. So I figured out two really important things. One is, the best vacation home is your friends, and it sort of goes along the same way with a boat.
Yeah.
Boat is your friends.
Oh, yeah. I've had boats I would say my whole life, but half my life. First half of my life, I had boats. I had three. And, you know, they went up in ascending order, you know. I had this old beat-up kind of thing, and then we had a center console 22-footer. And then my father and I kind of bought this 30-foot sport fisherman. And it's a pain in the neck. I mean, you know, you don't have 12 months out of it. You know, you got maybe 6-7 months, and then you got to dock it, whatever. And like you say, the cleaning and the docking, and, you know, I'm off on Mondays trying to get somebody to go with you. Everybody else is working. It was just a pain in the ass. So I didn't do it. But I had a townhouse down by Naples. I was in South Fort Myers. It was about maybe a half an hour from Naples. And I used to go to Naples all the time because there's a great scene there. You know, that town is like, it's almost like East Hampton. You know, you have all these restaurants and boutiques and stuff. It was a lot of fun to go down there. And I built the house on a whim. It's funny how it happened. I was in the middle of writing my first book, you know, about my 100 worst customers ever. And I'm thinking about all that stuff. And I went into this place. It was called, what was it called? Lurkat. It was a restaurant called Lurkat. L-U-R-K-A-T, I think it was called. And it was a pretty cool little restaurant. But anyway, I go in there, and it was a hostess desk there, and it was a big backup. There was a whole bunch of people in front of the hostess desk. So I'm kind of hanging back. I just want to go to the bar, have a glass of wine, and maybe an appetizer. So I'm kind of hanging back, you know, waiting to see what happens. And I hear the hostess going to this couple, "I know you had a reservation for 7:30, but we had a problem in the kitchen, and it's probably going to be another half an hour. I'm really sorry." And the couple goes, "Okay." And I went, "Okay? I get sued for this stuff. You know, I got lawyers, you know, I get arguments, threats, the whole thing, right?" So I called my girlfriend at the time, and I said, "Listen, I'm going to build a house down here." She goes, "You're going to build a house down here on the west coast of Florida?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "What do you know about this area down here?" I said, "Well, I know everybody's blonde. Everybody has their own boobs and lips, and nobody's screaming at a waitress. I found Valhalla, you know. I'm in, like, the nicest place I could possibly be." So I did. I wound up, I didn't build it, obviously, but I had a townhouse built down there. And I liked it a lot. But you know what happens, Stu? Just like Miami in the 80s and the 70s, the building got so crazy. I remember leaving my condo and going down to a 7-Eleven, which was maybe 8 minutes down the block. And it took me 45 minutes to go down there and get a paper because of all the construction vehicles. And I looked around. I said to myself, you know, this is what Miami looked like in the 70s when they had the building boom and bust.
Well, I got to tell you, driving out to Montauk, I left at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I felt like I was on a construction parade.
Oh, well, it's a trade parade. You didn't know about that?
Oh, no. Yeah. And coming back, when I got out there about 3:30 on Thursday. The parade leaving.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
No, you got to get to the Shinnecock Canal before 6 or after 9. You can't go between 6:30 and 9. It's nuts. But yeah, it's interesting, you know. You see, I mean, I didn't really love Southwest Florida. It was okay, you know. But I just saw this, and it turned out I was right. I'm going back a ways. I think I built the thing for like $230,000, whatever it was, and by the time I was going to sell it a couple of years later, it was up to $500,000. You know, so I said, "Well, this is a pretty good thing. Let me flip this," you know. And then my friend Marty said, "Listen, you know, don't sell it yet. You know, Anna and the kids and I want to come down for Christmas." I said, "Oh, all right. Well, you go use the apartment for Christmas, you know, and maybe I'll come down and visit you for a couple of days." And then that was in November. From that point to when he vacated the thing, you know, the day after Christmas, it already lost about $45,000-$50,000.
Wow.
So it was, you know, and now I think you could probably buy it for almost what I paid for it years ago. You know, I mean, we sold it. You know, we made a really good profit on it. I think we sold it for $460 or whatever it was. But
holy cow, there's a knock at the door. It's a thought about Thanksgiving.
Ah, really?
So here we are talking about Montauk and Florida and all this great stuff.
Yeah.
But Thanksgiving is like down the road.
Yeah, it's Thursday. So are you ready? I mean,
I'm ready.
You done your shopping? And
well, first of all, yesterday, Thursday, Stu Leonard's at his two locations here on Long Island, in East Meadow and in Farmingdale, gave away about 500 turkeys.
Really?
To underprivileged families.
Good for
And the
him.
Radio station was lucky to have been involved. We had a initiative on air where people could nominate a charity to distribute turkeys to. And so we were involved with giving away about 40 turkeys, and it's real easy when somebody else is providing the turkeys.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Kudos and thank you to Stu Leonard and his family and his employees for all they do. And Stu happened to be here on Thursday at Farmingdale, and he lives a different life than I. So
he's not a blue collar guy.
Well. So I said to him, because he's always coming in and saying how he's hosting the family and he's got the turkey and his wife eats the salmon, whatever. So he's talking. I said, you know, what are you doing? He goes, "Oh, we're going to my sister's house." I said, "That's great. You get out of, cooking the bird and everything." He goes, "Well, I got them cooking a bird a special way for me today."
Oh, yeah?
And he pulls it out of his pocket.
Oh, and the oven bags?
The oven bags.
Yeah.
And I thought this was like a condom commercial because this package says turkey size.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't, you know, I've seen that done. I guess it keeps it moist or whatever.
So I said, he goes, Stu, have you ever seen, you know, these bags? And I said, well, I'm sort of familiar with, just like you said, Tom, the chicken version. I don't know that my mom ever used it or whatever, but at any rate, so Stu's talking about cooking in a bag, and then he's talking about these potatoes from the Orient, from Japan, that make you live to 100.
Oh, really?
Purple potatoes or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, before I could, you know, let my mind wander, I'm in the store buying my turkey bag,
mm-hmm.
and I bought some of the life-enhancing potatoes.
You're a victim of merchandising,
yeah.
You know that,
and then
right?
Sure enough, there's Stu. You know, again, he's got a different life. He's just taking whatever he wants, putting it in his pocket or whatever, you know.
Nice.
But, yeah, so where I would first have to go to my mom to cook my turkey, you know, Stu's got the chef's preparing his bird in a bag. He's going to check it out, see how it comes out or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. I've cooked a lot of turkeys in my life. Obviously, I've worked the last 55 Thanksgivings in a row. Never really used a bag, you know. Doesn't really appeal to me.
So I got to say, you know, if you're buying a bag to cook in,
mm-hmm.
And you're buying for chicken, you know, there's a chance you might have multiple opportunities to use it. But I got to talk to the people at Reynolds because...
How many bags in a box?
There's two, but I would think this is a single-use purchase.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you could have two turkeys. I mean, Thanksgiving, if you have 27 people or something in the house.
I'm thinking most people end up buying a two-pack here, yeah. And they throw one away because they lose it. And when they're ready for it again, they go to the store and buy another box.
Oh, why not ham in a bag at that point? I mean, what's the difference?
So now you're talking. So I have to say that the one thing that I think is one of the most incredible discoveries ever is steaming bags.
Really?
I'm a big guy. We've talked about...
Like bigger than the polio vaccine and all of that?
Yeah, bigger and better. I'm not a big... I don't like stream beans when they're too crisp and like that. So, and even like Brussels sprouts, I don't like them to...
No, certain vegetables should be soft.
Yeah, so sure. I found that about steamer bags, and originally what I found out there's ones that have like an adhesive and you fold it over and you put it in, but they're incredible. Absolutely incredible. And then Ziploc comes out with their own version that they put a Ziploc thing. Now, the only thing with any cooking like this is that you got to really watch it when you open it. It's like intense heat.
Yeah, well, steam is hot.
But
you know.
In today's world, that's no different than all these different microwave cooked meals where there's a foil and a cellophane and you lift it up because it's... very.
Have you bought stock in any of these? You sound like an infomercial.
No,
you're like a bag man.
Yeah, really. So, but just again, it's so easy for the guy like me that doesn't really use a stove. Everything's cooked in a microwave. But then we were talking about the bags. Sous vide sort of uses bags.
Well, you have to have bag because you submerge it in water, you know, so it has to be covered.
So
you know.
There was a grand discussion going on.
Uh-huh.
And I believe this will now lead us to Thanksgiving cuisine.
In a bag.
Bag or bagless?
It's got to be a good song title. Stewie's got a brand new bag. Yeah, it was a James Brown song, right? Papa's got a brand new bag. All right, anyway, Thanksgiving. Oh, before we talk about that, can I make an announcement or two?
Sure.
Okay. One is Tuesday night, if you have no plans, no chores, and no responsibility, I'm playing a gig with guitar player extraordinaire Mike Dorio at Teddy's in Oyster Bay at about 7:30, and it's an open mic night later on. Mike and I are going to do... You know, one extended set, and then we're going to invite people up to, you know, play, sing, dance, sway, whatever they do. And a good time be had for all. I guarantee a rocking good time. And I expect to see some friends there. It's usually pretty busy at Teddy's. So it's kind of a fun night. Like I said, Michael and I will do a bunch of tunes. And then
is that where you hang out with Jimmy?
Jimmy
Fallon.
Oh, no, no, no. Jimmy Fallon was at Burnett's. But, yeah, no, it's a fun night. And, you know, if you're a player or a singer or, you want to come down and showcase your talent, you know, we're happy to have you come up and do a couple of tunes. It's always a fun night. So if anybody can make it out there, it's Teddy's at 2 o'clock. At 2 o'clock. Teddy's at Oyster Bay on Tuesday at 7:30. So that's
I
that.
I hope to get there.
Well, you get every place else, you should show up, you know. Also, you know what? Before we talk about Thanksgiving, I'm totally willing to do that. But I went to a new restaurant, for me, a new restaurant. It's been around a little while, in Lindenhurst the other night. Which the only other restaurant I've been to in Lindenhurst was the Village Tavern, you know, the German restaurant there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a place a little south of that on the east side of the street, just south of with the railroad tracks there, called Hermanas. And Hermana is sisters in Spanish, if you don't know. And it's a Spanish restaurant, but it's not like, you know, a lot of people think Spanish restaurants are Mexican. This isn't one of those, I always classify those restaurants as kind of a red pile, brown pile, green pile, sour cream, and everything kind of looks the same. There's a couple of Spanish or Mexican restaurants that are different, like what's the one in Huntington there?
Besito?
Besito, yeah. They do a great job there. But a lot of the Spanish restaurants or the Mexican restaurants kind of have the same sort of thing. This is completely different. This is modern Spanish food done really well. I mean, I'm very rarely knocked out by a restaurant, you know, because I've eaten in so many and, you know, I've had so much food over the years that it's hard to really make me sit up and go, oh, my, whoa, that was really good. And, you know, it doesn't have to be an expensive, over-the-top tasting menu kind of restaurant. You know, I've been knocked out by little Greek places. And anyway, Hermanas is one of those. I was way impressed. I mean, they had a cool little wine by the glass list. It's not big. Place is small. There's a little bar in the back, left-hand side, and then some tables up front. But what we had, we ordered a couple of things. We had this seared, like very rare raw kind of seared tuna in like an Aji Amarillo sauce. Aji Amarillo is a spicy yellow pepper kind of sauce with fresh avocado and cilantro. It was great. And then we ordered empanadas. And empanadas can be a little tricky because the dough can be heavy sometimes. And they fry them. And, you know, if it's the oil's not the right temperature, it gets soggy and mushy, whatever. Anyway, we ordered this empanada with portobello mushroom and truffle inside. It was fabulous. I mean, the dough was light and crisp, and the filling was kicking. We had a pupusa, which is usually like a little thin, it's almost like a stuffed pancake kind of thing, with black beans and cajeta cheese. But this was a little thicker. This was a thicker one. It came with a salsa roja, which was very good, a red sauce. What else do we have there? Oh, we had two tacos. We had a pernil, which is pork, which was exemplary good. And we had a blackened shrimp, which was good, but it wasn't as crazy good as the pork taco. I tell you what, the food was smoking, man. I was, like, really impressed to the point where I said, hey, listen, you know, you want to come on the radio show. So I have two guests kind of line up coming. The guy from Citrus, I have to give him a call, Rolando.
Sure.
And then this woman, I think her name was Lauren. From
I bet
Hermanas.
You she's one of the sisters.
I said, are you one of the Hermanas? And he said, yeah, I am. Okay. But, yeah, good little restaurant. If you're anywhere near Lindenhurst and you're feeling like you want to have some interesting food, artfully presented and carefully prepared, Hermanas, I was really blown away to the point where I'm going to go back and check out the rest of the menu because it all looked great, you know. Interesting, you know, they have a guacamole and chips, and they have a couple of like little, you know, small plates for, you know, starting and sharing, and then they have a list of appetizers, entrees. It's very, very good. You know, who's ever doing the cooking in the back? I think I saw the one guy, it looked like he was Hispanic, you know, probably Central American or whatever. But yeah, I mean, wow. I was like, wow, very cool. Okay, now we can take a little break and we'll come back and talk about Thanksgiving.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM. Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shordell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Okay, so Thursday is Thanksgiving. I don't know about the home thing because I never cook at home, and I've never made Thanksgiving at home, thank God. But I guess people start like Sunday, right, getting vegetables and shopping and getting all your stuff together.
I went to the supermarket the other day, and there were a whole bunch of turkeys in the case, and they were thawing out. I guess they must have been in the freezer, and then they put them in the refrigerated area, like where they would put chickens and stuff like that. First of all, how long does it take to defrost the turkey to get it to that point where it's thawed out, and and then once it's thawed out, how long can it stay in the refrigerator? And what's your take on fresh killed as compared to frozen and turkeys?
Well, in a nutshell, I mean, I think fresh turkeys are always going to be a little better, you know, than something that's been in the freezer, because you don't know how long it's been there, you know. There's nothing wrong with freezing a bird. I mean, it's, you know, fine. I mean, we have great freezing techniques now. But, you know, it could be in there from last year. You don't know. I mean, you know, so, you know, if you can get fresh turkeys, and generally you have to go, I would think, I don't shop at supermarkets, but, you know, I would think a butcher would be the place to go. A place like Main Street Meats or Treasure Isle in Mineola. Main Street Meats in Farmingdale. I think, you know, if you
and
go...
there's always Zorn's.
And Zorn's, yeah. You go put your order in and you get a fresh killed turkey there. As far as thawing them out, I mean, you know, wisdom, you know, prevailing wisdom will tell you you want to thaw out your bird in the refrigerator. You know, that's the safest way to do it. Probably take you 2 days, I would think, you know, by the time it's really ready to go. I just think that, you know, if you can, you buy a fresh bird. You don't have to worry about the thawing process. You don't have to worry about it still being a little frozen on the inside, whatever. And then again, I'm not a big proponent of stuffing the bird for a couple of reasons. One is the health risk. You know, if you get a little bit, if it's a little rare on the inside, you can wind up in trouble.
But what about the briming?
Brining?
Brining, and then there's people that put different ingredients under the skin, and then you do it, up and down, or do you cook it on its side or upside down?
I think since you only do it once a year, you should make a real effort to make it special, you know? And some of the tricks that people, you know, the beer can thing, standing it up straight, I don't buy into much of that. But as far as brining is great because it incorporates a lot of moisture into the turkey. So most brines are basically just a lot of water and a little bit of salt and sugar.
I've heard of people cooking it in a bag. I'm not talking about the plastic bags. I was talking about like supermarket brown bags.
Yeah, well, you can do that, but I don't know why, you know, you would do that. I guess, look, the bags trap the steam. That's the, you know.
I guess that's where we're going. I guess everybody wants a juicy bird.
Well, if you brine it, you don't have to bag it. You know what I mean? Brine it, don't bag it, would be my mantra.
And when you brine it, what is brine?
brine is just you know, moisture. It's what it's water, you know, flavored water. It's usually flavored with salt, sugar, a little bit of herbs. You know, you can put some rosemary and thyme in there, garlic if you want.
I hear a lot about citrus and thyme.
Yeah, you can put citrus in there. You know, oranges. I think lemons are a little strong. I would use oranges.
And cloves, they belong in hams, not turkeys?
No, you can use cloves. I mean, any kind of flavor is kind of good, you know. So what that does is that water, you know, soaks into the meat. So now you have a really wet bird going in there, you know. You don't want to pat it dry, and then you're going to roast it like normal. But what I like to do is I like to put butter under the skin. So after you brine it, you take it out. Put butter under the skin. I take slices of butter and put it, you know, if you kind of slip your hand under where the breast comes by the hole where the, you know, the legs are, you can move the skin, you slip your hand under there. And you can put, you know, I've put truffles under there. I've put all kinds of stuff under there. But for the most part, butter and herb butter, you know, you make a little herb butter with fresh herbs and butter. That's always good in there. That gives it a nice little flavor. And basting isn't a terrible idea. You know, they used to have those big basting needles or tubes or whatever. You know, my grandmother had one with a rubber ball on the end, soak up the juice. And always make sure that you put a little water in the bottom of your pan. So when I cook a turkey, I put a base down of onions, carrots, celery, a little bit of whole garlic, rosemary, and thyme. And that's going to be used to flavor my gravy later, right? But if you don't put a little water in there, because your bird's going to be in the oven probably for 4 hours or so, 4 or 5 hours, you know, it's going to burn, and then you're going to have this bitterness in your sauce. You don't want that to happen. So when you get the bird and you put it on that mirepoix mix, which is, again, like I said, it's carrots, celery, and onions, and the herbs and the garlic, then make sure you put like a, you know, a quart of water in there, and then check it periodically as you're cooking, because if the water evaporates, you're still going to burn the vegetables, and you don't want a bitterness. And then once you get the bird out, and it's finished, whether you're using the oven, you know, popper thermometer in it, or, you know, my advice would be a meat thermometer. And if you stick that in the thigh, you want about 165 degrees, and you're good to go. And then take the bird out, and then you have these vegetables in this kind of, you know, you'll have a lot of runoff from the bird, so there'll be flavor in there. And what happens is the vegetables and sometimes the fat from the turkey will stick to the bottom of the pan. And that's called fond, F-O-N-D. The French call that fond, and that's what you want to. That's what's going to flavor your gravy also. So when you take the bird out, what I do is I take the whole pan and I put it on the range, on the stove. And I like the stove, you know, like a small fire under that. And I scrape with a wooden spoon, I scrape all of that, you know, good stuff up. And then you're going to add your, you know, what I would do is I would add, some people would add water. I would add stock like collagen chicken broth. Or turkey broth, they probably sell both, and then make your gravy that way, and then you can thicken it with a roux or cornstarch or flour, however you want to do it. But all that flavor is what you want, and you strain that out, so you'll have the flavor from the onions, the carrots, the celery, the garlic, the thyme, and the rosemary, all in your gravy, coming right from the oven. So it's a good way to do it. I mean, if you want to try the bag thing, I guess so, but I think you're better off brining it. If you can find a, you know, a vessel that you can, that'll hold a, you know, 16 or 20 pound turkey, whatever size you decide to get. you know, I'm sure Home Depot has a bunch of that stuff. You just get yourself a plastic container and you can brine the bird in there. And it comes out great. It comes out, you know, juicy and moist. You know, I've heard that frying thing is cool, but, you know, make sure if you're going to do that, fry the bird, deep fry the bird, I would do it outside somewhere. You know, people burn the house down trying to do that stuff. It's crazy, you know. And I don't think it's going to really make a big, I don't know, I've never had it, but my culinary sense tells me that the outside is going to get more well done by the time the inside is done. So I'm not a big fan of that. I think, you know, the slow roast at 350 degrees or 365 degrees, something around there, is your best bet, you know. And you know, we've been roasting turkeys for years. All this, you know, frying turkey thing started, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was. But, you know, you need a lot of fat. You know, it's dangerous because you have oil and you have fire. And that's always a, you know, if you're going to do it in the backyard, away from the house, you know, do anything stupid. Because I've heard they can go up pretty good. So And that's my thing on turkey. I think that you should just, you know, make it special, you know, and try and get it as nice and moist as you possibly can. The great part about turkey is even if you dry it out a little, there's usually a lot of gravy, so you can moisten it up with that.
Well, I think that's where we're going. What about the gravy?
Well, like I said, there's a couple of ways to do it. But the best way, I think, is to make it out of the pan that, you know, like I just said, the pan that you roasted the bird in. You can make it with, you know, turkey stock or chicken stock. You can do a different thing. But I think that's the best way because you get all the flavors from the turkey and the vegetables in there. And, you know, also, I think, you know, what I do is, you know, I cook so many turkeys. I mean, I'll probably cook 40 turkeys this week. And, you know, I'll take all those carcasses and I'll make a stock out of that and make a soup. You know, so I'll make a turkey soup for, you know, a couple of days after.
Both scenarios. With the gravy, I mean, obviously there can always be like an au jus, or there's a thicker gravy where you add, what is it called, roux?
And yeah, I use roux, which is a 50-50 flour and butter mixture. You can use cornstarch. Preferably, there's a thing called arrowroot. And arrowroot is like cornstarch, has the same texture.
So is traditionally, you know, a turkey gravy a thick gravy or the au jus?
Yeah, no, it's thicker. But, I mean, not gloppy. You know, there are people that thicken it too much, and then it becomes this, it's almost like a wallpaper
and
paste.
And then when you do your turkey soup, is that a broth, or is it more of a cream?
I've done it both ways. I like to add a little body to it. I think cream is better, you know. Thing is, it's a hard sell because everybody knows what you're doing, you know what I mean, in a restaurant, you know, turkey soup, you know, 2 days after, you know, it's kind of hard to disguise, you know. But what's wrong with that? I mean, you know, we only eat turkey really once a year. I mean, I defy you to go into a restaurant other than maybe a diner and try and find a turkey.
So it's funny. Yesterday I heard people talking about, you know, the leftovers and day after type stuff. And somebody made the comment, there's a lot of, it's a Thanksgiving sandwich.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the turkey, and it's stuffing, and it's the cranberry sauce, and maybe some people even put, the string bean casserole on there or whatever. But the one thing that always seems duplicative.
Oh, no. Duplicative? Yeah, now he's got me saying it's like string of Pelopanes. Duplicitous. Duplicative.
Is putting stuffing on a sandwich, but the stuffing is already more of a, it's not bread at that point.
I mean, duplicated is what you were trying to find. Yeah, okay.
Well, now I have you pondering what I'm trying to say.
I mean, it's just like I feel like I need a translator sometimes.
So, I you know, Monday mornings I come to work and Louise, my coworker, goes, oh, today's a three every day. yesterday's show, you mispronounced all these different things.
I had somebody tell me that, you know, the Christmas season is starting early. And he didn't like it. He says, pretty soon they're going to have that guy with the bell out there from the Starvation Army. Starvation Army. Wow. Who knew?
It wasn't me.
It wasn't you. No, that wasn't you.
So what else? What other tips? I mean, one tradition that I don't know where it comes from, but my grandmother used to always have to dress the turkey. And what does that mean? The turkey had to have these little ornaments around its legs.
Oh, yeah, little thing, the frilly things?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's necessary, to tell you the truth. You know, another tradition that I think people should break is the canned cranberry sauce. You know, you open both ends and you push it out, and it still has the shape of the can, and then they cut it and, you know, and whatever pieces.
Well,
whatever.
I'm a big compote guy. I know. When I was shopping at Stu Leonard's yesterday, there was cranberry and citrus.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't gelled, so it was more like a sauce.
It's easy to make, too. It's, you know. It's...
And actually, I have to get to Trader Joe's. They make a more of a lumpier one. It's cranberry and orange.
Yeah, well, that's because the cranberries have.
And then Ben's, you always talk about Ben's when you where you go for your kasha and your mushroom barley.
Yeah, it's my Jewish soul food fix I get every once in a while.
But they make a nice compote with cranberry, with the berries, actually.
Yeah.
Some pineapple, some walnuts. My problem is I always go for a quart container when I should be buying a pound container.
A pint,
But to me, there's nothing better.
Listen, fresh cranberry sauce is the way to go. I mean, it's easy to make. You know, it's cranberries, sugar, and water. I mean, you don't even need water. It's cranberries and sugar, really. And you'll find you need a lot of sugar. Cranberries are tart as it gets. But you add a little citrus in there, some orange zest or whatever. It's great. It takes 20 minutes, maybe. You know, it's like applesauce. I mean, people buy applesauce. I'm like, why? You know, you just all you need is, you know, peeled apples, cut them up, put them in a thing with a little bit of sugar and light a nice little low flame under there and wait. You know, you can put it on and wait, watch a TV show or whatever.
So you a white meat man or a dark meat man?
I'm a dark meat guy. I like flavor. I'll eat white meat, but it's kind of boring to me. Doesn't have much going on. All the fat's in the thigh, you know, the thigh. And same thing with chickens. I mean, you know, I use a lot of chicken thighs. I serve it to the help all the time, too, because it's, A, it's good, it's nutritious, whatever, and, you know, tastes good. But so, I think the breast dries out, you know.
So now, Italians many times will have lasagna as part of their offering for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's like an amuse.
But other than turkey, I guess people also do ham?
I've heard that, yeah. I've heard people do ham.
Or is ham more Easter, am I thinking?
I think ham's probably a little more Easter.
So what other things might they bring to the table? Again, Stu would always talk about salmon, I think.
Yeah, well, I believe it or not, I sell a lot of salmon on Thanksgiving. I sell a lot of non-turkey dinners. I mean, people just, I don't know, for whatever reason. So whenever I do, you know, Thanksgiving, I always have, you know, short ribs or a sirloin and a salmon or, you know, cod, a halibut or whatever. Because people always cop to, you know, that. I couldn't eat turkey for a lot of years. You know, when I was 16, I was working this restaurant with, you know, Shorty. And we all know who Shorty is, my mentor, the gun-toting, profane, alcoholic Shorty. Shorty put 300 people down with salmonella poisoning on Thanksgiving. I was one of them, and if you've ever had salmonella, it's the greatest weight loss plant program you could ever get on, but it's miserable, and I couldn't look at turkey for probably 10 years after that, and I never ate turkey on Thanksgiving. I would eat the vegetables and whatever, but there's some people that just don't enjoy it, and you know, so we always have salmon or we always have some kind of fish. I think that's, you know, individual families. Most people will eat turkey. And if you have people who can't eat it, so I guess you bring a fish or whatever, you know. So, are vegetarians, obviously, now, vegans who can't eat that.
So I'll be down in South Carolina. So we found a really nice steakhouse that we will be dining at on the level of a Rothman's or a Bryant & Cooper or a Rare 360. I just have to make the comment, as good as the restaurants up here are, that restaurant is that much nicer. I don't know if it's about the Southern hospitality, but, I mean, if you have three people serving your table up here, there's seven people serving you. I mean, they, like, parade
really?
your meal to you.
Nice.
They just but it's always interesting. You know, when you go to a restaurant for Thanksgiving, what people order. Again, I have to be involved in the holiday, so I usually will go with the turkey or whatever. But at the same time, people are ordering steaks whatever. And
I'd say that in my experience, we probably sell 20% non-turkey meals. Maybe even a little higher than that, you know. So I'm like you. I mean, I eat it once a year, you know, whatever it is. You know, I don't eat turkey sandwiches. That's the only other turkey you see people eating for the rest of the year. I mean, nobody goes home and mom roasted a turkey on
January 12th.
Well, that's
funny. In the old days, Carrie used to cook a turkey breast all the time.
Really?
All the time. So much so that her 16-year-old daughter now can't stand turkey.
Yeah. OD'd. She OD'd. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I don't know. I don't know why it doesn't get more. I mean, it's really, it's a big chicken, you know. I mean, you wonder why. I mean, people eat chicken like it's going out of style. I guess it's not, you know, portion wise, you know, you can't have a turkey leg. It's just, you look like Henry VIII, you know, chewing off a turkey leg. But yeah, it's mostly sandwiches and I guess hot turkey sandwiches. So I do this thing called a hot brown sometimes for lunch, which is like an open faced turkey sandwich with bacon, tomato and cheese melted over. It's almost like a half an open faced sandwich, half a grilled cheese kind of thing, you know, and it sells pretty well once in a while, but it's only once in a while. And excuse me, I'll get a turkey breast in, I'll roast it off and, you know, slice it and do that thing. But
and what type of cheese do you put on that?
Cheddar. Yeah, nice. You use Swiss would work, you know. I use cheddar because I think it has a little more punch, you know.
And what type of bread?
Whole wheat or white rye, you know. I tend not to use white because it's too boring, so I'll use like a nut wheat or something, like a, you know, cranberry wheat or something interesting like
that. You a sourdough guy?
I love sourdough. Love sourdough. Yeah, I stay away from bread. I'm not a big bread eater, honestly. I don't eat sandwiches. I don't eat hamburgers, really. Once in a while, maybe I'll have 3 hamburgers a year, you know, and it's only because I'm in a hurry and we made it for family meal for the boys, and I'll just grab one or whatever. But yeah, I don't really enjoy bread. I enjoy bread on its own, you know, dipped in olive oil, and, you know, but I don't like sandwiches. It's too much for me. It's too, you know.
So that be said, if you were to do bread and butter, which it sounds like you wouldn't normally do, unsalted butter or salted butter or flavored butter?
I tend to use unsalted butter for one main reason, is that you can tell when it's rancid. Yeah, you laugh, but it's true. I mean, you know, butter, you know, especially commercially, I mean, I get cases of this stuff, right? And salt preserves it beyond where it should be. So what I do is, if I have every once in a while, I'll get a roll and I'll heat it up, you know. And most of the times I'll use olive oil because I have very good extra virgin olive oil. But sometimes butter is just, you know, calling me. And so, you know, we use unsalted butter. I always put a little salt on it just because, you know, that's where the flavor is. I mean, it brings out the flavor of the butter. You know, unsalted butter on a roll is kind of boring, you know. But if you're a purist like I am, I mean, I just think it's the way to go because, you know, the salt in the butter preserves it beyond what its shelf life should be. And you can't tell, you know, if you have it. So I can tell right away if the butter's good or not, if it's unsalted. So we tend to go that way, Stu. And then I'll salt, you know, beyond that, I'll salt if I'm, you know, putting butter on a bread or a roll, so English muffins.
I know that for me, one of the greatest luxuries is to have a nice crisp baguette. And you mentioned some cheddar cheese before.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good day.
So to me, you know what I really enjoy every once in a while, and I don't eat them that often anymore, is the English muffin. For two reasons. One, I just like the nooks and crannies thing because it holds the butter and pools in there. Second reason is I was named after my grandfather. My grandfather was Thomas, right? He was from Liverpool. And so he worked for Thomas's English Muffins. Now, my grandfather's English, right? And he worked for Thomas's English Muffins. And I thought he owned the company until I was about 12, right? And I'm thinking, I'm on Easy Street here, man. All I got to do is be good to that guy, and, you know, I'll have this company on my hands. And he did nothing to dispel the myth. Now, he dressed in a suit every day. Even when he was off, for Saturdays, he would watch the baseball game with a tie on, you know, whole thing. Drove a Cadillac. I was convinced he was wealthy. It was hilarious, you know. So every time I eat an English muffin, I think of him, and it's always a great memory, you know. But there's something about that. I mean, I tried to make them one time. It didn't work out real well. I'd have to work on it a little bit. That's a specific thing. I mean, you know, there's nothing like an English muffin.
So how do you cut an English muffin?
In half.
I know, but how do you
way?
Do it? Do you do it with a fork?
No,
I
separate
it
with my fingers, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. But I actually like, I prefer hamburgers on an English muffin than I do on a roll. And apparently I'm in the minority. I have people, you know, it's funny with the hamburger thing, right? You know, some people want Kaiser rolls, some people want hamburger rolls, a potato roll, a, you know, this roll, that roll, gluten-free roll. I just think that English muffin is the way to go. It's not as bready or doughy or whatever, you know, and I think it has a better flavor than most of the hamburger rolls do, which have no flavor whatsoever. Anyway, why are we talking about hamburgers? It's Thanksgiving. So give me a favorite vegetable.
I believe Brussels sprouts.
Really?
Brussels sprouts and turnips.
You are an oddball, I got to tell you. Yeah, nobody likes Brussels sprouts more than me, but, you know, it's not anybody I know. It's not their favorite vegetable, but you surprised me with that. So I'm going to give you an idea how to get all the flavor you can possibly get out of Brussels sprouts. And I need you to basically steam them first or boil them first, right? Till they get a little soft, and then shock them in cold water. And then heat up a pan with a little olive oil in it and get it hot, almost to the point where it's smoking, right? And then just put the Brussels sprouts in there. Now, there's other ways to flavor it. I mean, bacon, this, that, and the other thing. I'm just talking about the Brussels sprouts itself. You get a hot, hot pan. You put them in there, and you leave them sit for a minute or two. Don't get so jittery and try and shake them up and toss them around with a spoon or anything. Just let them sit and let the leaves on the outside almost blacken, and then toss them a little. So you got to let them sit for 3 or 4 minutes, and then toss them a little. And a little bit of salt and just a very, very slight pinch of sugar. And if you really want to get funky, add a little cider vinegar in there. Cider vinegar and butter, yeah. You'll have a great little fully caramelized, very, very flavorful Brussels sprout. If you want to go crazy, what you can do is you can do the same thing and then toss them with blue cheese and bacon, you know, which is always cool, and apple. Take a little diced apple, blue cheese and bacon, toss it with the Brussels sprouts, and you'll light up the family's Thanksgiving table, I swear.
I'm sure I would.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is like you were talking about before, how certain vegetables shouldn't be al dente. And I agree with you. I think that there's a, you know, if you go to Italy, they don't cook their green beans so it snaps and you have that bite thing. They cook them till they're soft, you know. And I think green beans is one of those vegetables that benefit from a little extra cooking. Now, Nouvelle Cuisine and, you know, and a lot of chefs will tell you, oh, you know, they should be al dente and, you know, to the bite, whatever. And there's a case to be made for that, for sure. But I prefer them a little softer. That's one of the – and Brussels sprouts and broccoli rabe. Broccoli rabe, when it's al dente, is a chewy mess as far as I'm concerned. It should almost be stewed. Not Schrager, I mean stewed, you know, EW. And, you know, and cooked to a point where it's very soft. And I think that's where most of the flavor from broccoli rabe comes with it.
Broccoli rabe is a tough one because most of the time I'll call it stringy.
Well, that's because it's not cooked enough. If you cook it down, you won't have that. You won't get that stringiness, that sort of texture. You know, it's soft and it's chewable, and I much prefer it that way. I've had cooks argue with me about that, and it's good to be king, so I have the last word. But the bottom line is, you know, there's for me, I think those three vegetables for sure are the ones that should be cooked and softened to the point where, you know, you don't have that bite to it. And I think more flavor is there, and it's easier to eat and probably easier to digest. So that's my final word on it. So it's time to go, Stu. Kind of flew by, right?
It did.
Yeah. It seems like just an hour ago we were starting this show. So we're going to close the show with Tom's three keys to life, which are, as usual, life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. Keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And by all means, enjoy the Thanksgiving dinner. We have a lot to be thankful for in this country. And, you know, we're lucky to be here. So think about that. And we will see you next week. Happy Thanksgiving, Stu.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at AmanoRestaurant.com.